He stands like one lying down, held up entirely by his great will, distant as mothers when they nurse, bound within himself like a reef. And the arrows come, now and now, as if they sprang from his loins, iron trembling with their free ends, yet he smiles darkly, unharmed. Only once does his sorrow grow, and his eyes lie painfully bare, until they deny something, as if insignificant, as if scornfully letting go, the destroyers of a beautiful thing. Sankt Sebastian by Rainer Maria Rilke.
Welcome back to Historical Homos, the world's only no-fucks-given guide to queer history. Today we're looking at my direct biological ancestor, Saint Sebastian, who was once a prominent soldier in the Roman army before he became a martyr of the early Christian church in AD 288. That old soldier to saint pipeline. Nowadays, though, pretty much everyone agrees he is the gayest looking saint ever. But it's not clear why. Despite all artistic evidence to the contrary, plus his obviously limp-wristed name, Sebastian doesn't seem to have been particularly gay. In fact, in the few sources we have about him, Seb comes down to us as a rugged patron saint of soldiers, athletes, and archers. All of which sounds hot, but not strictly, or at least not exclusively, homo. Yet, from the Renaissance onward, Saint Sebastian is almost always portrayed as a beautiful twink of yore, penetrated all over by not-so-subtle shafts of phallic innuendo. To make matters even more urgently gay, Saint Sebastian is also one of the most frequently depicted figures in Christian iconography, almost as much as Jesus and Mary, which means he loved the gayest thing of all. Attention. So what's going on here? Were these sodomite painters of the Italian Renaissance just desperate for softcore twink porn in their grinderless misery? How did the admittedly gentle but clearly quite butch Saint Sebastian of the early church become the lithe, half-naked Timothée Chalamet that we know today? It's time to get to the bottom of this bottom. So cast off your pesky loincloths and get ready to dive in, because the water is what, Eric?
Human temperature.
Take another rewrite through our history. H-O-N-O. Celebrate ourselves tonight. Uncover all the things that still a mystery. H-O-N-O. Cause if you think you know, you don't know. Around the world we go, 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 go. Time to blow your mind with historical homos.
Okay, and we are back. I am so excited to introduce you all to our guest this week. Ladies and gentlemen, put your ears together for Eric Thomas. Now, actually, let me ask you a question, Eric. Do you go by R. Eric Thomas, or do you go by Eric?
Online and in writing, I go by R. Eric Thomas, but like to people, I just go by Eric. It just makes me easier to Google.
Okay. It's also very authorial and distinguished, I think, to just have that sort of lonely R at the top.
I do think having like a vestigial name is like really something that denotes that you are high class. Although when I started going by R actually at my high school graduation, I listed myself as R. Eric Thomas in the program for the first time. And my high school principal at the time was like, Eric, there's a thin line between classy and pretentious. And I've never figured out which side of the line that he thought I was on. And that's the entirety of my brand.
And you've spent the rest of your life trying to figure out what that line is. Well, yeah. as you may have guessed, everyone, Eric is an author, a playwright. He is a hilarious and definitely future historical homo. I've been listening to his memoirs on the audiobook version of his memoirs on Spotify. So I feel like I've been hanging out with him for a week already. But I'm so glad to have you on the podcast. Thank you for coming on today, Eric.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I love this podcast. I adore you. And I'm very excited about our subject today. It's one of my favorites.
Now, we also need to let everyone everyone in on the little secret that we actually met at a gala. Wow, we do sound very sort of pretentious, but also high class.
We met at a gala.
We met at a gala. This was not just any gala. This was a moth ball, so celebrating the organization The Moth, of which you are a major part, having hosted many of their shows. And but the real tea was that we were seated across from Carol Radziwill, Real Housewife of New York, as well as her kind of hot husband or boyfriend, or
a very hot man who did not feel the need to, very friendly, but did not feel the need to entertain our attention.
No, well, there was something very queer going on between Carol and our side of the table, and he wisely did not interrupt that flow.
He was like, this is ladies' business. And we were like, yes, yes it is.
We were ladies who were lunching. I remember large goblets of white wine and just staring at Carol's plastic surgery, which looks great.
Yeah, it looks incredible. In fact, it was so, the whole thing was so beguiling. The wine, Carol, you, that I almost won the silent auction for your vacation home or your villa.
Okay, how pretentious and high class can we get?
I know. It was such a tragedy. I got so drunk and outbid myself for your villa. And then I thought to myself, well, who am I going to bring? An army of twinks?
I was so drenched with Chardonnay, darling, that I could hardly afford your villa. Wow. Stunning. Stunning beginning to this episode already. So anyway, everyone, that's how we know each other. White wine, Real Housewives, and villas in France. So you said you're excited about our topic today. I'm interested in your relationship to queer history, if any. I also saw that you went to Columbia, where I also attended. Again, pretentious, high class. and so I think you were talking about taking the like introduction to masterpieces of Western art, or whatever they call it, in the core curriculum at that acclaimed college. But what's your relationship with queer history, if any?
Well, I am rapidly becoming a queer elder, and so I'm fading away like Marty McFly's relatives.
I can barely see you.
Yeah, you truly. No, that's just the filter, darling. I'm sort of obsessed with in the same way that you are, kind of excavating this like hidden in plain sight history that we all share. There's that Alicia Wormsley quote, there are black people in the future, which I love. And I think it's something that I also like to think through, is like there are queer people in the past. And those two are sort of like the two poles of my identity. For those listening and not looking, I am black and also extremely hot. So just you have a mental picture there. Thank you. Yeah, that was the cue. No, but I think about I write plays as well as TV and film and books, and so a lot of my plays are focused on researching aspects of queer history or queer life that I know must have been there, but haven't seen before. Whether it's excavating like the queer rights movement in the 50s, just a time that I just wasn't around for, or going further back in American history, going to different countries and continents and sort of looking at what queerness looked like there in the past. It's just like, I think for me, it's about shoring up the foundation of my own identity, but also like getting some like real tea. I'm very like, You know how like everybody in the past stank, you know, I can't think about it too much, but I'm like, somebody, you know, some soldier came back from World War II and was like, what if I do this with my penis instead? And you're like, that maybe that you're give him the Pulitzer Prize. truly. And I'm like, these girls are doing this without gun oil. And that is, they should put them on our money. It's important.
The fact that like every guest I've had on this podcast for I think 3 weeks now has brought up like lube in some format, and like how were people because we know they were fucking, like that's not
right.
Sodomy done been around, everyone, like we know that. True. People did it, but how and with what? And was it nice or was it mean sodomy? I'm actively researching that right now so that I can do an episode on the history of bottoming and just the history of anal.
You're a real hero.
I will be on money one day. Okay, so speaking of men deciding to put their penises in other men, which is groundbreaking, mm-hmm. you recently did the unthinkable and went to Italy to look at art.
brave.
which is, said the New York Times, which is one of the reasons that I wanted to do this episode with you, because this Saint Sebastian story is so much a visual story. So thank God we chose this visual medium for it. But tell me a little bit about that experience, because you were tracking it on Instagram, which was LOL, but it was also it seemed earnest and very genuine that you were enjoying the fuck out of yourself.
I loved it, and yes, earnest and LOL is absolutely the plane I'm on. I had I had done very little planning for this trip, but I'd never been to Italy, and it was sort of the idea of a friend of mine. And when I got there, I was like, wait, this is where they keep all that art. I truly was like Annie in Daddy Warbucks' house. I was like, you'll let me look at this Caravaggio? But it took me back to masterpieces of Western art. And so many of the artists that really opened my brain up and moved me, Bernini, Caravaggio, Michelangelo, I got to see in person, which is like, that's the whole deal. But like, I think if I had been like, I'm going to go over there and I'm going to look at the David and I'm going to look at, the Medusa and whatnot. I think I would have had an expectation, and instead it felt like, oh, everywhere I turn, there is such sumptuous beauty and so much complexity and so much artwork that I think about all the time. That's like here on my walls. And I feel like I sound like somebody who's like, have you heard of a museum? And there was a sense of discovery to like in being in the place where you're like, wait a minute, some queen just like picked up a paintbrush and did this. Like that's cuckoo crazy.
Okay. The other thing I want to ask you about before we get into Saint Sebastian is, in listening to your memoir, I take it you grew up quite religious. So tell me a little bit about that, because I assume you're not Catholic, but are you into the saints?
So not really into the saints. I grew up Baptist. And so we were like kind of aware of John the Baptist. Sure. And we like
kind of the HBIC there.
Yeah, truly. Although like it's like kind of underutilized. So we're kind of aware of the apostles, aware of the people who would be saints, but like truly not aware of what saintdom or sainthood really was at all. And so like my first sort of interaction with the saints was honestly in college, in these core courses, where they're like, this is how other people think. And I was like, oh, that's wild. But it is interesting seeing these different depictions in Italy of John the Baptist and Judas and whoever and Mary, and like seeing like when you see them depicted 50 times over the course of like one museum visit, like I love that they're always in their little uniforms. You know, Mary's in blue or red sometimes, and Jesus is in red, and especially after the resurrection, or blue. John the Baptist always has his little like furry little like lamb's wool or like whatever thing. His little shrug. Yeah.
His stole.
He's like, I've just come in from martini lunch. Judas is usually in yellow, and I was like, wait a minute. This is an Avengers poster.
Right.
Like, everyone's wearing their little costume. They've got their little tool. All the saints, Matthew and Mark, all have the, like, instruments of their martyrdom. And I'm like, oh, I get it. Like, these people, like, they didn't have, Thanos. They just had the crucifixion. And they were like, that's enough.
Yeah, totally. I actually, in looking at some of the Saint Sebastians, I was like, especially in the Renaissance, there is a kind of like comic book era where I feel like they're kind of depicting him in his like origin story version. And they have all of these different like weird settings around him. And like, obviously the arrows, the pathos of his face, until you get later on. And then it just becomes about literally having a hot dude with like one arrow. But yeah, no, that's so interesting that you came to that conclusion, because I think naturally as a young gay child, I rebelled. Again, I was raised Catholic. Both my parents were Catholic. Mm. And my dad was kind of like actually into Catholicism in a serious way. So I kind of rebelled by being super into Greek mythology and paganism and really believing that that was real. Like I vividly remember I was age like 6 or 7 or something. And I came home and I like started crying on my parents' bed and they were like, "What's wrong?" And I was like, "I just realized that Mount Olympus is not real." And I'll never get to go there.
Even worse.
Importantly, how does this impact me? But so I had like a weird Catholic aunt who wanted to be a nun. She was always trying to like push the saints on me. And she would buy these like saint cards that were sort of became like fun collectibles for me. This was also the era of Pokemon. So she really knew her audience.
A little Catholic Pokemon.
Yeah. So these little Catholic Pokemon, like, and this is, I think, how they were perceived back in the day to some extent as well, because they sort of took over from all the gods and the heroes, right? And we'll talk about this with Saint Sebastian a little bit, but they were those Avenger figures. Like, they had special powers. You prayed to them for specific reasons. I think that it was a way of connecting to the divine in a way that was much more varied than just the sort of one and true God, which is like, okay, great, there's one God, but that's kind of dull, you know.
Right. I think that's such a fascinating perspective, particularly like on Greek mythology and the connection to the saints, and like having a cast of characters. It's like, oh, this is an ensemble piece.
Yeah.
And who doesn't love like a really rich ensemble? The White Lotus, if you will.
Listen, we are already getting too fascinating and we haven't even kicked off the episode. So let's dive into it and look at where the original Saint Sebastian actually came from before we start talking about his Renaissance twink glow up. Act 1, Desperately Seeking Sebastian. Okay, so who was Saint Sebastian? Now, for the listeners, I like to start with some context, right? So we think Saint Sebastian was born sometime around the 250s AD, so early. And in general, the Roman Empire is like the biggest it's ever been, but it's also starting to, you know, tear at the seams because of that. Mm-hmm. And in particular, there is a series of persecutions against Christians that gets increasingly more intense, kind of from the 250s to the 300s, culminating in the Diocletianic persecutions. Remember that word forever, Diocletianic.
Oh yeah, it's got tattooed across my back.
And it is, and that's really kind of like the pinnacle of the Roman emperors trying to do away with the Christians, right? Because Diocletian is this emperor in the 280s, 90s, who sees himself as the restorer of pagan Roman glory. And he's like, enough, I can't take these pesky Christians, especially in the eastern part of the empire, you know, where they were from, Palestine, Israel, that whole region. So it's time to snuff them out once and for all. Of course, he fails miserably, because by 324 AD, Constantine the Great will be emperor. And on his deathbed, on his deathbed, he converts to Christianity or makes it the official state religion or something like that.
Actually, idiot, Constantine converted in AD 312. There was a later rumor that he was only baptized on his deathbed in 337, but that was just a rumor, you gossip-hungry gay.
But after Constantine, it's like, we're all Christian now.
This back and forth is exhausting. Like, old people arguing about religion is truly the most annoying thing in all of, like, for all of human history.
Get a job.
Calm down. Get a job. Stay away from her. her being whoever, the pagans, the Christians, the whoevers. It's amazing to me that every story is like, well, this emperor didn't like that people were praying to somebody different, and so he decided to kill them all. And then, whoops, he turned around and, like, you know, effed himself over, and now everybody's Christian. Girl, get a hobby.
Well, the interesting thing, though, about Christianity is that, well, and the Romans, is that the Romans were actually pretty good at absorbing local religions, right? Because everybody was pagan. Mm. So there was a lot of, I think the official word is called syncretism. There's a lot of gods meshing mm-hmm. together. Obviously, you have the official gods like Jupiter and Minerva and all mm-hmm. of these ones that you can find anywhere you go. But then they start to sort of meld together with local gods. So in the eastern part of the empire, they'll be kind of like old Babylonian gods and stuff like that merging together. Mm-hmm. In Britain, they'll be Celtic gods merging together with them. And so the emperors are actually pretty fine with you worshiping who and what you please. But you just have to also worship the state religion. That's all you have to do. Mm-hmm. So the thing about the Christians is that their big thing is like, nuh-uh, I'm not doing that one thing that you're asking me to do because there is only one true God, right? So and obviously the Jews had already invented that, and the Romans had plenty of gave the Jews plenty of trouble as well. But the Christians become more popular. So it starts to threaten imperial autonomy, because if you're not worshiping the state religion, then you're fucking with Rome, right? And you don't fuck with Rome. So, I mean, it's fascist nonsense, but there is there is a rhyme and a reason to it.
You're like, look, this is bad fascism, but also, like, makes sense. I'm like, yeah, you know, they did fill out all the proper paperwork.
Okay, so back to Sebastian. He's born... Sebastian is actually French, which is also gay. He's born in Narbo, which is the Latin word for Narbonne, which is in the south of France, sort of south central of France. And interestingly, Christians were more tolerated in the Western Roman Empire than in the Eastern part of it. So like Italy, Gaul, France, Spain. Mm-hmm. And then... we think he was born to a relatively wealthy family, although literally every saint is high class and pretentious. Like it's like a part of their, not every single one, but it's a very common trope with these stories of saints, probably because they wanted to sort of PR them and be like, look, the rich people are doing it. You should too.
So what you're saying is every saint is a Nepo baby, but Sebastian is a Narbo baby.
Okay, very good, very good, very good.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was off the cuff. You need to know that. That was not scripted. So we do think it makes sense that he would have been part of a wealthy family, because he kind of reaches a very exalted post within the military, the Roman military, quickly. He will eventually become part of the Praetorian Guard, which you don't just get into. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense. He probably was educated somewhere in Italy. There's a narrative around him going to Milan and being educated there. He was raised as a Christian, which was still relatively uncommon in the time, though more and more wealthy families were becoming Christian. And as we just said, that was sort of pushing it even further amongst the masses. Nothing like rich people signing up for something to market it, you know. Influencer marketing was alive and well at this time.
I love it. This is the Bored Ape of the 200s.
So he eventually goes to Rome and joins the army when he's around 30 years old. So already not a twink. Old as hell in gay years. And what's interesting about this is that he has to kind of be in the closet as a Christian, right? Mm. So he becomes part of Saint Sebastian's whole shtick is that he's very good at converting people, right? Like all good saints are. Mm-hmm. But he has to do it on the DL. So he's kind of a DL Christian. And he is personally having to remain in the closet so that no one finds out in this very, you know, high up position that he's in, i.e. the emperor. Because the Praetorian Guard is basically the imperial bodyguard. Mm-hmm. So they're like the personal army of the emperor. But little old Sebastian is perfectly happy denying his true self if it means that he can help out some Christians in need. And this actually leads us to a story that sort of makes it, it's what kicks off his martyrdom. So, and it's actually the martyrdom of two other saints, these guys, Marcus and Marcellianus, who are also rich, also living in Rome, nepo babies who are very adamant Christians, and they get arrested for it. Saint Sebastian comes and visits them in prison and says, "Don't worry, girls, keep going, like, stick to your guns. It doesn't matter if you die because heaven is around the corner and it's so much better than here." Stuff that we've all heard before, of course, when considering martyrdom as a professional path. So, and meanwhile, their parents, Marcus and Marcellianus, their brothers, their parents come in and they try to convince them to just say that they're pagan and then be Christians on the side. Saint Sebastian says, no, you guys are wrong. He converts the parents as well. Then he starts to convert everyone involved in the case. So he converts the prefect of Rome. He converts the judge. He converts the jailer, the stenographer, the stenographer's wife.
Oh my God.
Who's also...
Mrs. Stenographer is like just sitting at her house and she's like, who's this hot man coming in here talking about Jesus?
But she loves it. And she is in fact mute. She is unable to speak and then suddenly is able to speak after she sees the light and receives the Lord into her life. The prefect of Rome, a guy named Chromatius, then frees all his slaves and resigns from his post while also releasing Marcus and Marcellianus, who are all super happy that they can be open Christians again, until some little bastard narcs on them and they all land in prison. They all die except for Sebastian, and Marcus and Marcellianus are martyred in a particularly gruesome way. They're like hung upside down from a column of marble for a couple days until some people come and mercifully stab them.
Oh my god.
So it doesn't end well for Marcus and Marcellianus.
Or the stenographer's
right,
wife.
Zoe.
Zoe, what a fan. You know what? I'm already pitching an NBC series called Zoe the Stenographer's Wife, who's just like, I don't know, that guy seems like trouble. Oh, wait a minute. No, this is actually, I really want to do a modern version of this. Okay, I'm sorry. This is why
you came on this podcast, to find your next project.
Truly. This is a general.
So Sebastian makes it out alive, but not for long, because everyone's like, wow, you're super good at converting people. Maybe that means that you're a little bit gay. Sorry, I mean Christian. So then Sebastian's martyrdom begins. And you know, if you're thinking this is kind of a stilted story, all of these stories about saints are. Like, they just sort of jump from one thing to another. So don't expect any transitions. It's martyrdom time for Sebastian now. And there are two stages to Sebastian's martyrdom. He likes to draw it out. So when he's discovered to be Christian and to have converted a few too many of his fellow soldiers, the Emperor Diocletian calls him into his chamber and says... Oh, and let me read this quote, because this actually comes from the original source. "I have always loved thee well, and have made thee master of my palace. How then hast thou been Christian privily against my health, and in despite of our gods?"
What a phenomenal sentence. How hast thou been Christian privily against my health? I think there's a lot of people in contemporary America who are being Christian against people's health. not all Christians,
it's a
obviously.
It's a specialty.
But like, yeah, there's a sect that's like, oh no, I do want to like walk into like Joel Osteen's church and be like, "You have been Christian publicly against my health and despite our goals."
Oh, I know. It's very diva. And then you can see the connection here between like the state religion and the emperor's like, you know, well-being and stature. Like, if you're not praying to the gods on behalf of the emperor, you're actively harming the state.
Interesting, yeah.
So Saint Sebastian is like, "Don't worry, boo-boo, I'm praying for you." Every Christian's favorite thing to say. And then he... adds, you know, by the way, I think you guys all sacrificing to these stone marble statues is stupid. You should stop. And then Diocletian is like, you're annoying me. You're going to be shot by arrows. And then they tie him up. He commands these Praetorian guards to tie him up and shoot him to death by archer firing squad. And the source that we have says he was as full of arrows as an urchin is full of pricks. And
okay, a little purple prose. I think I'd probably pull that back.
And I think I'll just let that simmer, full of pricks.
last weekend. Okay, go ahead.
So they stuff him full of their pricks and then leave him there for dead. And a Christian, somehow he survives this, which in AD 288 or whatever, I'm really surprised given the sort of general approach to first aid. But right. A Christian widow named Irene, who I'm sure becomes a saint because she did this, finds him, nurses him back to health. And it seems like, you know, he kind of gets a second chance at everything. And this is actually
deranged.
But this is actually a crucial detail that he survives the arrows, because it's part of the reason that he'll become such a sought after saint, because he actually survives death. Right. And that's kind of like a Jesus like kind of a Jesus move. But right. but he's yet he will become associated with plague and sickness and surviving these terrible ordeals. So, like every Christian, he just doesn't know when to quit. Sorry, every early church Christian, he doesn't know when to quit. And he presents himself, he finds Diocletian again, and he's like, Diocletian, stop being so mean to all the other Christians. Actually, he's like, I'm back, first of all. What's up?
He like walks in there holding his side, you know, yeah. Like holes in all his body, all holes everywhere.
He's just a hole, sir.
He's just a hole. He's like, knock, 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 hole here. Deranged. And he's like, wait, first place I'm going to go as soon as I stop gushing blood is Diocletian's house. Diocletian's like, girl, we got a whole world. I don't know if you know, but there's undiscovered countries. Go bleed over there.
Do something else. Do something new. Like, no, but this is why Sebastian became a saint, because he has a one-track mind. And Diocletian is, so he sees this gaping, beautiful twink before him, and he's like, aren't you the same girl that I just condemned to death? And Sebastian is like, well, obviously God kept me alive so that I could come back and tell you you're being a dick to all of the Christians, who, I'll say it again, are all praying for you. So Diocletian then says, LOL, I condemn you to death again. And this time it is to death by stoning. So this time Sebastian actually does die. And interesting. I know, we were just getting to like him. We were just starting to identify with the character after he was full of pricks. But this is, interestingly, this is his actual martyrdom, right? Kind of beaten to death in an alley behind the imperial palace. But there are very few paintings of this scene. I came across a couple of them. But the one that we're all familiar with, of course, is the arrows. So let's keep that in mind for when we look at his revival in the Renaissance, because I think there's an important reason for that. But his body's then thrown into the sewers, gross. And then he appears to yet another widow, who hilariously is actually called Saint Lucy, which is my sister's name. And Sebastian appears to Saint Lucy and says, go find my body. I promise it's not covered in poop, but it is in the sewer. So go get it and bury me. And then his remains are supposedly believed to be held in the Basilica of San Sebastiano outside of the walls in Rome. So you can still go there and pray to Saint Sebastian. So, martyred, AD 288, 5 years after enlisting in the army, a relatively short career.
That's why you shouldn't go to the army. You know, if you have a hobby that takes up all your time and involves the stenographer's wife changing her entire lifestyle, you maybe don't have time for a second career of fighting, you know, crime or whatever you do in the army.
Right.
This is exhausting to me. I also feel like Romans should have really settled on like one style of condemning to death. The guy's like spinning a wheel. He's like, arrowed. Didn't get him. Stones. Baby, you are in the ancient world. You can sneeze on somebody wrong and they will die. Or just wait until they're 37. Isn't hard.
Just wait until they're 37. Literally go play in traffic. Like, you will die.
Yeah. They will all experience twink death as actual death.
So poor old aging twink Sebastian really has to go through it. He keeps coming back. It does. It's good for his reputation in the end that he is this kind of death cheater, right? Because that will become a really big deal to people as they're worshiping him in the Middle Ages and later on. But I think at this point, I mean, we've kind of been tracking a little bit. We have to ask ourselves: is there anything gay so far about Sebastian in this story? Like, we homosexuals read into it. I think there is a lot about living in the closet as a Christian in the pagan army that resonates.
Yeah. What if DL people like converted people? Like, what if you had some DL guy over to just like do a secret hookup and he was like, have you thought about being gay? And you're like, what? Oh man, I thought we were just gonna watch TV and smoke. Anyway,
that's true. That's true, though. I'm sort of like, why would they believe him? You know, it's right. Like, honey, you're not living your truth. Right. I guess the fact that he likes secrets is also kind of gay. I mean, it's giving queer Scorpio energy.
Yeah.
He's also clearly addicted to drama.
Oh my gosh,
because he is arrow murdered and then comes back for more.
Yeah, he's that queen who gets kicked out of one bar and then sneaks in the back door and is like, yeah. Happy Pride. Oh, my Lord.
Doesn't know when to quit. So I guess that is gay. But
annoying.
Annoying and gay. I guess the getting tied up with rope, the arrow, like the arrow's obviously, yes, phallic, we know. But I don't know. I mean, I think Sebastian is homoerotic, but there's nothing to suggest in this story, at least at first glance, that he will become what he does in the Western canon, which is a pale, lithe, hairless Lana Del Rey listening twink of the Italian Renaissance. And that's where we will turn to next. Act 2, Rise of the Renaissance Twink. Okay, so we've got to figure out how we get from Saint Sebastian, the early Christian martyr, to the Middle Ages and then the Renaissance, right? And no one likes the Middle Ages, but there is stuff happening for the 1,000 years between Sebastian's death and the Name one thing. Name one person who lived in the Middle Ages.
Name one thing.
So unsurprisingly, the Middle Ages is known for being dirty, and therefore there is a lot of the Dirty Ages. That could be a fun rebrand, the Dirty Ages. So Sebastian in the Dirty Ages becomes much more of a like protector saint because he starts to be associated with the biggest problem, plague, right?
Oh, I thought you were going to say people's bad breath. But okay, yeah, that does seem bad too.
No, you gentle creature. Bad breath is not the worst thing that can happen to you in the Dirty Ages.
Boredom. Lack of TV. Only reruns on.
Boredom.
Friends has not yet been invented.
No, I love just straight boredom. like they must have had nothing to do. I guess some people had to like farm and stuff, but like, ugh.
Yeah, you know, they hunt and gather or whatever. But like, yeah, they're all like, well, let me make an illuminated manuscript. Oops, the sun went down. Guess I have to die for 8 hours.
The worst. Plague is here again. We're all dead. So Saint Sebastian, interestingly, becomes associated with Apollo, who was the Greek god of, and Phoebus is the Roman version, although the Romans didn't follow too much because he was a little too much of a fancy boy for them. But he becomes associated with Apollo iconographically because Apollo used to shoot arrows as well, right? Apollo's the god of archery. Mm-hmm. And the arrows of Apollo often represent, you know, divine retribution, pestilence, whatever sort of bad shit Apollo is sending down because someone's pissed him off. Even in the Bible, actually, there is reference to this. So there's a quote from Psalm 64 where they talk about God shooting at us with an arrow and suddenly becoming wounded. So there's this idea that like arrows from on high represent retribution or something bad, right? And so Sebastian's association with arrows very conveniently allows him to be associated with like invisible ills like sickness.
Right,
so
right.
In terms of Sebastian's sort of visual gayness in the Middle Ages, very little for us to go on. I have an example here from the 7th century. And I truly apologize that I am going to be talking, we're going to be talking about so many paintings in this audio podcast, but I'm going to link every painting in the episode description so you can click on it and follow along on your phone. But there's one from the 7th century from a basilica in Rome where he's literally just sort of like some dude, old, bearded, in a procession of other saints. Mm-hmm. Then there's another one that comes from like the 1400s, so we're jumping ahead a lot, where he does have kind of a stank face, resting bitch face. We could associate that with homosexuality, and in fact we will. But he's fully clothed, like, you know, he looks more like just an icon and not in the modern way.
He also looks
in the art history way.
Yeah, he also looks like Susan Sarandon in Rocky Horror. He's giving Janet, and you know, Frankenfurter is Diocletian. And he's like, oh, I know you did not just, because he's like holding this arrow, and he's like, it's like him knocking on the door, like, I think you left this in my pancreas, bitch. Incredible.
So follow along with all of those visual references, everyone. And then eventually we get to like the early 1300s or something around then. And everyone is having a lot of plague. So I don't know if you remember this from your high school history, but in the middle of the 14th century, it's the Black Plague.
Offensive.
Things are... Sorry, the non-denominational plague that affects everyone equally. And suddenly Saint Sebastian becomes really necessary and portrayed with like thousands of arrows inside of him. So it's like the more arrows he's stuffed with, like the more he's taking on that plague for you. So there's one painted by Giovanni del Biondo in the 1350s, which if you click on it, you'll see what I mean. It's like they're literally every inch of his flesh is covered in arrows. So obviously the priority here is like, please, Saint Sebastian, like, be a saint, be a buddy, and take this illness away from us. And actually, there was sort of a PR wave that crossed all over Europe after a city in Italy erected an altar to Saint Sebastian, and then their city sort of like did away with the plague.
Oh.
So then every other city is like, quick, we need an altar to Saint Sebastian. It's literally so pagan, like it's crazy.
So he's like Ivermectin or whatever that horse pill was that cured COVID. Like that's who he was.
Oh, I don't even know that word, but it sounds like a horse pill.
Yeah, there was something that, like, you know, if you get on like the right wing cuckoo crazy sites, they're like, take this horse thing and that cures COVID.
Yeah, absolutely. Or like when Trump was like,
I think he told people like drink bleach,
cleanse yourself from the inside. Yeah, it was about as likely to help as that. These altars to Saint Sebastian. Right. But lucky for our girl, it led to a lot of, you know, new pictures and paintings of him. being set up all over the place. So this kind of starts Saints. This really sets Saint Sebastian off in his career. This is his big break, the Black Plague. There's another one painted in the 1490s where he's like just this ugly ass man, like kneeling up in the clouds, full of arrows, praying directly to Jesus, being like, "Please stop all plague." It's good for his career. It's not a fun time for us looking for gay people in the visual evidence.
I do love that, like, Jesus in the clouds is like, "Can you get out of here?" Like, Jesus is like holding up one hand and it's like, "Enough." And Sebastian's like, "Hello, I'm here full of arrows. Oh my God, this queen is back.
You've been here for 150 years asking me the same question. I'm not getting rid of the plague."
I know. He's like, "Okay, well, did you learn some Mary Kay then? I don't know. I'm just, since I'm here."
He is the sort of pyramid scheme of the plague, Saint Sebastian. Going door to door. But then finally the Renaissance hits, right? I mean, the Renaissance doesn't hit. The Renaissance is a very gradual process. All of this knowledge is being transferred over from the ancient world. It was all preserved in the Middle East. It starts to be translated in the 1200s, 1300s. And then this also leads to a rediscovery of Roman and Greek art, right? People start to become, artists start to become obsessed with, obviously, you know, if you saw Middle Age art and then classical art, you'd be like, "Yeah, I'm going with classical art." Because it actually looks nice. This is the era of body, yaddy, yaddy, right? Mm-hmm. Like, everyone is interested in what the classical sculptors and artists were able to do with the human form. It's also the beginning of humanism. Philosophical ideas about how humans are actually important and not, like, the worst thing in the world, that you want to shuffle off your mortal coil and head to heaven as soon as you can. People in the Renaissance start to actually say, actually, being human is important. And good. So with all of these Renaissance...
Disagreeing.
hot take.
Hot take. Humans bad.
So with all of these artists obsessed with bodies, Saint Sebastian becomes super important because he is one of the few saints who can be depicted kind of naked, right? He's actually described in the text that we have that sort of gives his hagiography, the story of his martyrdom. He's described as Athleta Christi, which in Latin means like athlete of Christ, but also champion of Christ. So he's associated with athletics, with being a soldier. You know, he obviously has got some pecs under there, and all of these horny painters want to paint those pecs. So I think this is the really interesting thing that I never clocked and that really came together for me in this research, is that the Renaissance needed Saint Sebastian because he was naked, right? Because he could be naked. You cannot paint other saints naked. Like, it just does not happen. Jesus is the only other person that you can conceivably paint with some nudity. Mm. But, you know, even though he is the head honcho, people want some other stuff hanging in their churches and their homes, right? So, so this is a really important point, that Sebastian is the athletic saint, the soldier saint, and that's why he kind of becomes used and abused, right? Like, this pass around bottom for the Renaissance painters, because he's the only one who they can actually make naked.
I love that. I love that they were like, well, we need to see a body, and this guy has a body. It's like when you're like just Googling, when you're like a teenager and you're like just Googling like the male form, or yes, athletes, or the ESPN magazine's body issue. I'm just a connoisseur of the form. he's the one who's not wearing clothes. Or you know what it is? It's walking through where you're like, I don't know, maybe you didn't have this experience, but you walk through like a Target or whatever, and you're like, I'm just going to buy some underwear.
Of course.
I'm just a burgeoning sexuality. Oh, look, there's men in their underwear on these underwear packages. This is not my fault. Yes. This is their fault.
It's very that. I mean, this is a world without the internet, without Grindr, without magazines, without even the retro version of porn. And by the way, to answer that question, I grew up in the dial-up era, so I was looking at internet porn from like age 8. I did not need the Target section.
Okay, well, thanks for telling me that you are young.
I'm young and horny. What can I say? So like we said, though, it's really important to remember that these people are not painting in a vacuum, right? It's not, obviously, the church is like a big authority structure, infrastructure, right? And they commission a lot of artwork, but people start to commission artwork as well. That's another thing that changes, or not changes, but becomes more prominent in the Renaissance when more people start to be able to afford art. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like just the tiny little middle class that they allowed to develop. So the other reason that Saint Sebastian is popular is because people want to see him, right? These artists are not painting for their health. Mm-hmm. Sebastian's OnlyFans is blowing up. The capitalist market for Saint Sebastian is also helping fuel his career because people want some half-naked Christian iconography.
How much of this do you think was also about, like, it makes sense that it's like, well, he's half-naked, this is like a little thrill. How much of it was also about his, like annoying doggedness? Like, is there something about like the who he was, or was it really just the way he looked?
That's such a good question, and you're preempting my next point, which is that he's also got I love it. He's also got this origin story behind him, right? Going back to the kind of like X-Men approach to Christian saints that we were talking about. But like in the 1450s, for example, there's a very famous one that is painted by Andrea Mantegna. So if you look at that one, you can see that, okay, yes, we've got body adi adi here, but we've also got a sort of classical setting, which is interesting because a lot of Middle Ages artwork put saints into Middle Ages settings. Mm-hmm. So it's very classicizing. Then you've got that kind of Renaissance floor on the bottom with those tiles. Okay, we're doing a little bit of a remix here. We're bringing it into the modern era at the time. Then you've got stuff going on in the background. And then crucially, you have this gorgeous beatific face staring up at the heavens with a fucking arrow right through his neck head.
It's gruesome.
And I think this is one of the most important things for viewers about Saint Sebastian, is that like Jesus, he is calm in the face, like a lot of saints, but like Jesus, he's very calm in the face of torture, right? And there's this kind of impassive and sort of almost, you know, like, so what? Look on his face.
Bored twink.
While he's being tortured. So it seems silly to us, but I think this was a powerful story for people who were super religious, right? That there was this kind of like badass figure who went through these terrible torments, but still was a hot twink looking up at the divine. So it's all to say, back to your point, that it's the psychology behind Sebastian that is just as important as his physical looks, which are obviously top notch.
I do love the idea of all of these, you know, people in the Renaissance being inspired by like truly like Troy Sivan, looking impassive and but also slightly pained. Like it's iconic.
Bored like, but traumatized.
Like this little beautiful boy, he's so sad, but he's so beautiful. I will also persevere in my daily travails.
I want to be gay and unhappy like him.
This is like the modern equivalent. It's like, he's like, oh my God, I have 6 Zooms today. And then I have a happy hour that I don't want to go to. And then this guy, I don't know what we're doing. I guess we'll go out. Maybe we'll hook up. The travail is, he suffered so much, and I am inspired to go on myself as well.
I'm sorry, Saint Sebastian as the bored office twink is my next play. That is also the meeting that we're having currently. Wow. He's like, by the way, Mama, you look fierce today.
He's like, I hate her.
She's such an ugly bitch. Okay, to follow this image up, everybody needs to click on Sandro Botticelli's Saint Sebastian. Oof. Who is serving pure cunt here.
Yes,
like,
oh my God.
It's actually hysterical. This is one of the funniest Saint Sebastians, I think, on record, because this bitch is being penetrated with military instruments and is just like, and so what? Like, gorgeous body, absolutely unflappable face. The contrapposto is contrapostoing. The arrows are almost like, you don't even see them at first. You just sort of see his face looking at you. The gaze is very direct, which is also different from the sort of gaze upward towards the good Lord. And it, to me, it's kind of giving Elle Woods like...
What, like it's hard?
Like,
absolutely. I'm also like, this queen just got his eyebrows waxed. Like, he like left the esthetician's office and outside was a bunch of arrows and he was like, oh no. Oh, but also slay.
Perfect timing. He got his entire body done. Electrolysis to the stars, honey.
No, truly.
I mean, he is absolutely hairless. It's unbelievable. So, and this, interestingly, the poem that we read at the top, that you read at the top of this episode, that was written by Rainer Maria Rilke, people think, based on this painting. So they think that was the inspiration, which is, and that's a beautiful poem. And I think it really captures some of this like bored twink energy of like staring, you mm-hmm. know, staring at the arrows being like, ugh, you came to destroy me. You can't.
Like, do you know who my father is?
I'm a God. Narbo baby, honey.
I'm a Narbo baby. Can someone call Zoe, the stenographer's wife, please? Oh my God, Zoe. You would not believe what they're doing to me right now. But whatever, I'll rise above. No, he's truly giving, like, my coffee is taking too long at this random Brooklyn, like, hipster, we only have oat milk coffee shop. And he's like, you know what? It's totally fine, babe.
Sort of.
But it's absolutely, not fine. It's not fine, but it's fine. You know, he's going to be
okay. I'm in London right now, and there's a lot of, like, very translucent, lanky twinks, like, sort of gliding around. Like, that's who this is. This has got to be one of my favorites. But, and you see what I mean, how it's, like, it's very body forward, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we're not actually exploring, like, Sebastian... the psychology of Sebastian very much. I don't think. I think it's like we're doing a lot more with form and showing off this, like, the gorgeousness of it all.
Yeah. The abdominal, both in this one and then also in the Montaigne, the abdominal, like, I was like, I've never seen a stomach like this. Like, they, like, and I guess it's, you know, he must be on testosterone, I would imagine. And I'm going to say it, he's juicing, you know, he's juicing.
I know. I wonder, like, what ab workouts they were doing at the time, because this is not what stomachs do. Like, there's always kind of, like, a weird, like, double-barreled quality to them.
Yeah, yeah.
His pecs are perfect. I will say that. I will give that to Botticelli. Yeah. The pecs, I envy those pecs. And we actually have this same sort of double-barreled one in the next one, which is... Oh, and by the way, Botticelli is like one of the gay... Like, we know he was actually gay. So I think it's important to track these queer painters as well as we're going through this Saint Sebastian story. The next one was... such a queer painter that his nickname was Il Sodoma. Guess the reference. So his is actually painted It was used as on something that is called a processional gonfalon, which is a word that I had never come across in my goddamn life. Gonfalone, maybe in Italian. And it's like one of those things that you hold up in a procession with the painting of the saint or the virgin or Jesus that everybody. Oh. So this is really meant to be like worshipped, right? So if we look at this one, we also have like gorgeous body, gorgeous face, arrow randomly through the neck, but he's fine.
Again, yeah, Lucy patched him up and sent him on his way.
All you need is a lonely Christian widow, and you'll be fine. This one does have a little more divine resonance, I think, in terms of like there's an angel kind of crowning him with his saintly crown of saintliness. He's looking up. If you look closely at this one, also you can see tears coming down his cheeks. These little translucent tears, which are gorgeously painted. So this one I feel is it's giving us origin story. It's giving us a little more mood. But I mean, the guy is like barely clothed, right? There is the loincloth is also not opaque in this one. It's giving hull. It's giving gauze.
He's got like a little like it's like his little he's wearing a beach wrap.
Barely a sarong.
Yeah, truly. He's like, he's at some, he's at that like clothing optional Coque del Mar in Puerto Rico. And he's like, I'm just going to wrap this up as I pat inside and make some sandwiches.
Literal direct quote from Saint Sebastian. I mean, it's just, and the other fun art historical thing for people who like art history is that Il Sodoma was obsessed with the Laocoon sculpture. So that was like an ancient Roman sculpture that was rediscovered. So if you look it up, it's Laocoon. And it's this guy from Greek mythology who's like twisting and turning, and you can see all of the muscles on display, and Saint Sebastian in this painting has a very similar pose to the main figure from that sculptural group. So this is, to me, this is sort of like peak Renaissance, classicizing, gorgeous body. It's idealized body, right? Like this is not your everyday body, even despite the weird abs. But it's also starting to look ahead to some of the psychology in terms of the tears coming down his face, right? Because the thing about Saint Sebastian and the thing that people sort of start to get into in Christian art is like divine ecstasy, basically. Like in a world without MDMA, all you need to do is pray. So there are a lot of depictions of this kind of sublime joy of divine worship and the experience of the divine. And I guess by getting an arrow through his neck, Saint Sebastian was sort of, really reaching his divine ecstasy climax there.
A little nipple twist, a little arrow to the neck, whatever gets you there.
All of God's children are welcome. This takes us to the next period, the next sort of artistic period, which is the Baroque, right? And now I kind of like to think of this as like the show your trauma part of like a drag race season, like all the girls have their kind of like their interview with Rue at the end where they give their sob story.
My mother left my sister and myself at a bus stop when I was 3.
Like it's time to show Sebastian's trauma. And like I said, there's like this thing with these crazy Catholics where it starts to get a little sexual, like the ecstasy of it all. There's obviously a very famous sculpture by Bernini of the divine ecstasy of Saint Teresa, where, I mean, the girl is fully clothed, but she is fully coming as well. As the good Lord intended. This is sort of in the later 1500s and early 1600s. But these Saint Sebastians are just like completely unfazed, and also don't really have a lot of arrows, like, going into them, right? Like,
I love the edit here. Like, it's like, it truly is like getting a note from a studio. They're like, love this, love the twink, love his face, love the stomach, love the nudity, love the sarong. Hey, could we do, like, 75% less arrows in the... this painting of the man being arrowed to death. Thank you so much.
Right. This is a family film. Like, we don't want the kids to know that he's getting right. how much pleasure he's getting from those arrows. So there's a very famous one, and I have to admit this is one of my favorites, by Guido Reni, that was painted in 1615. I mean, the word that comes to mind is sort of lackadaisical. Mm-hmm. Sebastian, he's just like got his arms above. He's like, whatever, like, it's Friday, you know, let your loincloth down. His body looks insane. Like, it's very, very full, you know, just deliciously full. Actually, I wouldn't say this is full twink. This is twunk. We're in twunk territory now. Facially, he's got that.
Yeah, he's in a bulk.
Yeah, he's in a bulk phase. Facially, he's got like a little bow mouth, like perfect little pink lips. He's looking up at the heavens as if to say to Jesus, like, are you coming? You know, like he's just like not experiencing any torment whatsoever.
I also like, I think one of the things about Baroque Sebastian is also like the sort of like ambivalence, the sort of lackadaisical, like you say. I also, not to be a weirdo about it, like Baroque Sebastian is when you start to get pit. And like, he's just like, he's truly that guy on Instagram who's like, you like this? Oh, I'm just stretching. Oh, I'm just going to stretch. But these pits are completely hairless. So, I'm like, in a world without Gillette,
right?
What's happening here, babe? Like, how are you shaving these pits? Like, I don't understand.
Think about pits. The pits on the Guido Reni St. Sebastian need their own PhD. Where is the pit hair? Exactly. Well, I guess the Romans were known for being pretty hairless, actually. But I don't think that they did underarm hair removal. So that's fucking crazy, actually. And also, like, there's something just kind of, you know, the background of this painting is very sexy blues and greens, like moody. It's giving Lana Del Rey. It's just very ethereal gorgeousness, which I think is also slightly different from, for example, the Botticelli one, where you still have like a full scene, you know, like he's kind of more in place somehow. Yeah. This one is just like, It's just the boy, ladies and gentlemen. And so that will actually carry over, I think, into this next one a little bit, which almost doesn't even depict this, like what you're expecting. So there's a Bernini Saint Sebastian, which I had never seen before. And it's amazing because Saint Sebastian, to me, looks like he's just had a good romp in the sack. Like, the girl is resting, right? Like, positively.
Yes.
Because we know Saint Sebastian didn't die from the arrows, so can't be dead.
Yeah.
The arrows themselves, I mean, you can probably notice them better when you're seeing the sculpture up close, but like, I can barely see them. Yeah, the first,
an afterthought.
The first thing you're drawn to is this gorgeous body where, I have to say, the abs are looking a little more ab-like now, a little more natural-esque, and the face is just completely serene, like calm. The loincloth is literally about to slip off of his cum gutters. He's got the V.
No, he's literally wearing this is a cum towel. Like, he, like, yeah. The face is so slack, and it's like this. I have seen this face all the time. You know, it's like,
okay, stop. You have sex. Stop bragging.
I don't know. That's not what I mean. I wouldn't possibly. Reminder to the listeners, I'm hot. No, but like, it is truly like, oh, we hooked up and now I'm going to like doze off a little bit. Like, that is truly, and I'm sleeping on like 1 to 2 arrows that are randomly in your bed and I don't really know why.
Yeah. It's insane. It's crazy. So I think this one is very much like just a vehicle for Bernini. He's like, look at how well I know the form.
Yeah.
Because this is not about story. This is this is to me not even about psychology, really. Like, it's just like a gorgeous portrait of an individual, mm-hmm. Of a specimen, really. So it's interesting. And obviously this story isn't linear, right? You don't go from like body, adi, adi in the Renaissance to like the psychology in the Baroque and all that. But like, I think you can see that it starts to get progressively pared down, right? From like telling a visual story about a saint to here's a hot, tired guy. like, let's take his clothes off. Inch by inch.
I also think it's interesting with Bernini especially. He is so good and about creating physical, emotional tension using physicality, like using face, using muscle. There's, you think about the rape of Proserpina, like there's a hand on Pluto's hand on her thigh.
Yeah.
You know, it was truly famous, like very famous. And like the tension in that hand and the impression of the hand on the thigh. And so when I look at this, or like, you know, there's the one of Daphne and Apollo.
Yeah.
You can see like there's tears streaming down Daphne's face, or there's one of what am I thinking of? The David. You can see like the his determination.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, so I'm like, Bernini was like, no, this is the emotion I want to show. This man is being arrowed lightly. And he's like, oh yeah, that's the stuff.
Yeah.
like no tension in this. Totally. There's no tension in this whatsoever.
It's true. It's a very undramatic portrayal of Saint Sebastian. But maybe that was kind of, maybe he was taking that sort of bored twink thing to an extreme here, mm-hmm. somewhat, you know, of like, there's nothing more unflappable than being asleep. So he's just like, yeah. He's just like, I'm fine with this, guys. I'm totally cool with the arrows, like water off a duck's back. I mean, it is. I think it's a bit weird for Bernini, but I also think that this might have just been an opportunity for him to show off the body. Mm-hmm. And we have to imagine also that he's working with a lot of competition, right? Like I said, there are hundreds, thousands of Saint Sebastians out there.
Yeah.
So the fact that he chose to do this very different version of it might have something to do with that as well. Like, it really stands out. Okay. Then our last one is just this guy named Nicolas Regnier, from 1620. And this is just full crystal meth twink, like yes. day three of a bender. Again, the arrows don't seem to be playing quite a big role. You can still see them so that we can identify who this tween is. But he is just like completely over it, limp wrists, you know. So again, to me, this is like a very individualistic portrait. Highly interpreted by the painter, not really giving us, not really focusing so much on the story, but on the connection between this very methed out Saint Sebastian and the divine.
I also love that he's like maybe 24 at most here, and
generous.
I mean, like, and like from what you said, Sebastian was like a dogmatic 30 something with a clipboard and an agenda. and this is giving like, oh, I dropped out of Vassar, but I'll probably go back next semester, I suppose.
So true. And that is one mystery that I have not unlocked, is why the sort of 30-year-old gay organized missionary of the early Saint Sebastian becomes this like tiny twink, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is like barely legal, Saint Sebastian. This is 1920, like,
yeah.
And she's not doing good. Everyone, everyone, make sure you look this one up. this one haunts me. So to conclude, the Middle Ages, we have this sort of protector from plague, stuffed full of arrows. And then the Renaissance becomes obsessed with bodies, particularly male, you know, idealized bodies. Sebastian is perfect for that because he's the athlete. He's the soldier of Christ. So he gets portrayed with increasingly fewer and fewer arrows, taking up valuable flesh real estate. Then he sort of becomes this beautiful boy who suffers, bored office twink. But, you know, I guess that might have helped him also become a gay icon later on, because he's kind of one of our sisters. He suffers, he gets it. And then there's kind of this Baroque twist on it where he's getting penetrated, and sometimes it hurts so good and he loves it so good.
Ain't hurt my feelings, but I like pain.
Sometimes it's just a kind of like beautiful in profile picture of a gorgeous man, kind of like emphasizing the individuality of Saint Sebastian. Okay, so now let's talk a little bit about what happened to Saint Sebastian in the modern era before I let you go. Act 3. Does anyone give a saintly shit? So at the end of every episode, we like to ask, does anyone care? I think you can tell from the absolute gay gushing that's been going on for, what is it, an hour and 20 minutes now. We care. We care.
We care.
We do care.
This is super.
But I think the interesting thing is, like, okay, yes, Saint Sebastian is homoerotic maybe in, like, the Renaissance and the Baroque, but, like, he really is a byword for gay nowadays. In fact, I think he really does have something to do with the idea that Sebastian is a gay name, which is something that I have experienced. That's my Sebastian trauma.
That's your arrow through the neck. Is someone being like,
we all have one.
Your name is gay.
We all have one.
Yeah.
So the question is, like, how did that happen? And I think one of the important things to remember is, like, all of this stuff was just, like, hanging out in Italy. All of these paintings, all of these sculptures, hanging out in Italy, maybe some parts of France and, like, Northern Europe. But in the 19th century, in the 18th and 19th centuries, what Europeans and a lot of Anglo-Europeans in particular start to do their grand tours, right, of Europe. So they encounter all of these Saint Sebastians, which are, again, depicted almost as much as Jesus and Mary. So everywhere you go, you're going to find a Saint Sebastian. And in the 1800s, one particularly famous homo, Oscar Wilde, becomes obsessed with Saint Sebastian after seeing Guido Reni's portrait that we were just talking about in Italy when he visits there.
Mm-hmm.
And we know he was obsessed with him because he adopts the pen name Sebastian in prison.
Iconic gay behavior.
Well, I love how he's like in prison for being gay. And he's like, everyone knows I'm gay now, so I might as well go by Sebastian.
Oh, my God. I
really adapted quickly.
I love us. He's like, it's truly like when you like go from being like, yo, I'm a bro, to being like, I'm a little monster, pause up.
A critical pipeline. Thank God for that pipeline. So, and then, you know, there start to be in the 1800s in particular and early 1900s, a lot of cultural depictions of Saint Sebastian. So Debussy, the French composer, writes a piece of music about a play, to accompany a play about Saint Sebastian called The Martyrdom of Saint Sebastian. Rainer Maria Rilke, the famous German poet, wrote the poem that we read at the top. There are references to Saint Sebastian in Thomas Mann's A Death in Venice, in George Orwell, Frank O'Hara, Yukio Mishima. I mean, everyone, especially, you know, this burgeoning sort of queer subculture, becomes obsessed with Saint Sebastian. And that kind of cultural, I mean, that was a very short cultural history of Saint Sebastian in the 20th century, but it all culminates, I think, in Derek Jarman's movie, Sebastiane, which is frankly extremely boring, but basically consists of 2 hours of naked men writhing on the beach because of God, I guess.
I do love that that's the natural arc. He starts like knocking on people's doors and ends like just like, we're just rolling around bored, yeah, naked, homosexual.
I guess that's our answer to what bored people in the Middle Ages did. They probably were on beaches writhing like, together.
You know what? That's one thing you never see in Middle Ages depiction. Like, people at the beach. Like, go on vacation. Yeah. Well, you gotta be smelting all the time?
Smelting or praying? Like, get a life. So, yeah, Derek Jarman has this movie about Saint Sebastian. I really don't recommend you see it, but you can watch clips on YouTube. It's and it's all about, like, Sebastian kind of enjoying the torture. So I think this kind of brings us to what is so attractive about Saint Sebastian, which actually Susan Sontag wrote about. And she wrote that Saint Sebastian is the exemplary sufferer, right? which I take issue with, because isn't that what Jesus is supposed to be? But I guess Saint Sebastian is like fully human, right? So it's a little bit what we were talking about with that you know, Greek mythology Avengers stuff. You can really identify with Saint Sebastian. And we have to imagine, like, there are a lot of queer Christians growing up in the 20th century, right? So I think encountering Saint Sebastian and knowing him as this kind of like gorgeous half-naked twink, but also someone who experiences torment and experiences pain, maybe some pleasure out of that pain too, you know, and suffers privately, but also because of this tradition has his suffering so publicly documented, you know, plastered all over the place. I think you can start to see why he would become associated with the gay experience, as well as, you know, having the clipboard and being organized in the 280s AD. But yeah, and then in like during the AIDS crisis, it's interesting, he starts to be reinterpreted because of his associations with plague and with disease. So there's a Keith Haring portrait of Saint Sebastian, which is kind of magnificent because it so completely exists outside of this twink tradition. Holy shit. You know, he's like this sort of demonic figure with a pretty big red dick there that I hadn't seen before.
He's fully erect.
There are planes penetrating him instead of arrows. So I don't pretend to understand what's going on here exactly. But a lot of gay artists appropriated the tradition of Saint Sebastian to a lot of gay artists who you know, had HIV also appropriated the tradition of Saint Sebastian to explore these themes and lean on his associations with illness. So yeah, that kind of takes us to the modern day. But what an odyssey. What a gay artistic odyssey.
You know, may we all have such wonderful legacies where our life's passion, the work that we did, our commitment to the things that we cared about the most are boiled down to us showing our hairless pits and inspiring people to be more beatifically annoying. I'm so inspired, I have to say. And I do like, I just love a twink conversion. You never see it. You never see it go backwards. You know, it's always like, obviously twink to twunk to daddy, to that, you know, whatever. Everybody's, you know, he did a
Benjamin
Button.
He had to die to be reborn as twink. Very Christian of him.
He did. St. Lucy was like, yes. Lucy was like, I'm going to take these arrows out, and also we're going to do a little microdermabrasion, and we're going to just do a little bit of tox, and I'm going to wax just a bit, and you're going to go out and slay. You're going to go to Diocletian and be like, who's this? Who's this new bitch on the block? It's me. Oh my God.
Now you can live forever, honey. Wow.
You will, Saint Sebastian, you will always be famous.
I cannot deal with Saint Lucy the esthetician. No, it's interesting.
Oh Lord, and I'm gonna get letters.
And I think the interesting thing for me also, like, obviously I grew up Catholic but didn't really care about it very much. But there is such a rich gay history in the history of Christianity. Like, everyone was Christian before, folks. So, like, all of the stuff in, like, Western art and philosophy and stuff, like, I feel like if you engage with it in these ways, like, you can kind of uncover the hidden threads. Like, I mean, that's why I said it's important to keep in mind that a lot of these painters were pretty flagrantly gay. Like, Botticelli was pretty gay, and actually, I think, wrote about his struggles with his because Florence was just a hotbed of sodomy at the time.
That's why I liked it so much.
Yeah, no, you felt at home.
It didn't seem very gay when I went there.
Well, Italy isn't very, they're not gay like on the surface, you know, which is where we're used to people being gay.
Yeah. I guess I should go down in the sewers and find Sebastian's body. Me and Lucy, like, what are you doing down
for
here?
For once. For once. Okay, put in the work, and then maybe you'll find Italian gays. Oh my God, that's so funny. And then there was, you know, Michelangelo, who was very gay. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows that or talks about that. I didn't know that until I was like 25 years old, and I read a ton of shit about this period. In my college years, Michelangelo wrote love poems to men. Mm. So there's a lot. And also there were debates about whether sodomy was really all that bad, since if it existed in the world, it must have been created by God, which is an argument that I think is actually pretty valid.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, there's all of these interesting. I just want to encourage us. I know Christianity is boring now, but in today's world. But if you're looking for queer history, like, there's a lot within it.
And I think that there is also just a lot of interesting conversation going on if you happen to be interested in modern Christianity around, like, ex-evangelical people finding a middle ground between their faith and their sexual orientation. And, you know, I don't think it's nearly like not nearly as interesting as Sebastian and his, you know, meeting up with the Ninja Turtles in the sewers and getting resurrected. But yeah, they're like, I think it's the inherent drama of Christianity sometimes gets like taken to a place that is too straight. And they're, you know, and then becomes fascist. And I do like reclaiming some of that drama and being like, girl, this all is a gag. Like, everything is such camp. And church is very gay, you know?
Especially Catholic church, as we all know.
Yeah. The costumes, the little songs.
Before we had Drag Race, we had Catholicism. Well, Eric, thank you so much for joining me on this gay odyssey. That was so fun. You are so hilarious. And I mean, it was just such a pleasure to talk about this with you because you're also so smart and you get it. So thank you for coming on.
Oh, this was my favorite afternoon in time. Sebastian, I have to say, you're a saint. High class pretentious. You look completely ambivalent and yet beautiful. I'm sure your abs are gorgeous. Giving pit. No, this was so fun. I love it. You're so smart. I was like, my goodness, you've like prepared a master's thesis on this.
If it's not well researched, I'm not interested. All right. Well, thank you so much. Thanks for joining us this week. If you like what you hear, give us a little 5-star rating on Apple or Spotify. Yeah, that's right. Just like that. Mommy likes when you listen. Oh, and follow us at historical.homos on Instagram and at historicalhomos on TikTok. Blah, blah, blah. Love you. Bye.